Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I think this is the best way. We're just frazzled journalists. Because I just can't.
True, underslept, frazzled journalists. Trying to make their way through this mystery.
That should actually be the way that the show opens. That should be the way. This might be the beginning of the episodes. I might just welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Tokyo Vice. I'm one half of your frazzled journalist dynamic duo here, Blake Howard. Joining me as always is one other frazzled journalist, the great Katie Walsh. Katie, welcome back.
We're going method this episode. We're underslept.
We're
drinking coffee and we're trying to make our way through the mysteries of Tokyo. And so we are actually trying to put ourselves into the brain of Tintin and Jake to try and figure out what's going on. I mean, we know what's going on, but...
Well, look, we've been doing Tokyo Nice. We've done 3 episodes of season 1 so far. So far as we've understood it, there are 8 episodes in this season. It appears that there's a little bit of confusion, as we said in previous episodes, about are there 10 episodes? Are there 8 episodes? Is this a 2-season thing? Is it a 1-season thing? This is a lot of weird conjecture, and nothing's really been confirmed yet. So we're just going to focus on episode to episode, which is why when you caught us in the middle of this introduction, which was not going to be the introduction, but it feels so on brand to be the introduction that it kind of needs to be the introduction of this episode. I'm going to let you just wallow in the confusion and our like confusion and being perplexed. So fourth episode, appropriately, I suppose, is I Want It That Way, which sees Samantha trying to shore up her future, getting herself her own club and then recruiting her own girls. And a figure interrupts those pursuits. Then also it's the final, first kind of moments that Jake, with the help of everyone in his office from Emmy to Tintin to Trendy, actually starts to make a bit of a breakthrough and connect the different cases together. And being the midway point of the series, we actually get to see Jake meet the big guy on the good Yakuza side. Katie, am I right in saying that, Chiharu-kun?
Are any of them good? I mean, I think that when it comes to Yakuza, like Chiharu-kai and Ishida specifically, they have a code of honor.
Yes.
You know, a man's got to have a code, as we all learned, and we all adhere to. And so they have kind of a specific code of the way things are and the way things have always been done. And so I guess we could say, I don't know, are they righteous? I don't know, but they're not necessarily as cutthroat and as nasty as the Tozawa guys.
Yeah, so we could probably say that they're a little bit more classic in their approach, which is like,
yes,
we will provide you protection. you will pay us. We have a system that we're adhering to, but we're not going to like ruthlessly berate you over the phone until you commit suicide, and so we can collect on your insurance.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Oh, that's so good. All right. Well, so here we are. This is an episode it's got it all. I want it that way. It's got a really wonderful scene that talks about the Backstreet Boys, which I can't wait to dive in with you, and the meaning, hidden or otherwise, in Backstreet Boys songs.
Can I tell you, I don't know. I never heard that theory.
I never did either, but I was like, all I can say is that's exactly the kind of show I want to see. When people are discussing 1990s pop hits to have hidden meanings, I'm in.
Yeah.
Especially in a crime show that just stops. It's a deeply kind of, this is the most this show has felt like that 90s independent new wave, Quentin Tarantino.
Yes.
Robert
Rodriguez,
totally. You know, Kevin Smith-esque, that didn't feel, I don't know, when that was still happening in the early 2000s, it was getting so tiresome, and even some of those directors couldn't get themselves out of their way with the desire to be intertextual, and it's really boring. But this was kind of cute. Like the
It was cute, and I think fundamentally, so, you know, we're talking about a scene where Sato and Jake talk about the Backstreet Boys song, I Want It That Way, and I'm Team Sato. It is a masterpiece. Like, that song is amazing. It will stand the test of time. It's a great song. And
I wholeheartedly agree, by the way.
Yes, and but it to me, I like at the end of the scene, what I was left with wasn't like, oh, that was a really cool analysis of you know, the Backstreet Boys, which is kind of what you get sometimes when you watch like a Tarantino film or a Tarantino imitator. What I got was, these are just kids. And here's how they're bonding. And even though they're caught up in this crime, Tokyo underbelly, like really dangerous world, fundamentally, they're just some guys having fun. And they're young and they are people and they're developing this friendship. And they're not just symbols. They're actual characters. So I really enjoyed it for that like little bonding moment between them and that reminder of who they actually are. So, you know, because it's something that you would like have a conversation with your own friends about with. And so, I thought that was really sweet. I enjoyed it. And it's like, it's entertaining too. And then there's a really fun callback where they're talking about NSYNC in the car, and then later Jake and Sato go to a club together and like Tearing at My Heart starts playing. And I just like love this moment where Jake's on the dance floor going, oh my God. And Sato's just giving him the bird, two birds. It's like, that's your friends. You're like bullshitting with each other and calling each other out. And like, you actually, it's a fun way to see their friendship grow.
Yeah. And it's funny because the line between two guys who are that age, who are talking about pop culture and talking about fashion and talking about this and that, there's a really beautiful balance, because you can see that Jake is sort of reaching back and connecting with home in all these talks of pop culture, and Sato is like is looking at this hopeful dream of something, you know, acquiring something, being away from this world. And the, I don't know, the kind of the parallel movement is that Jake gets further and further away from home and more detached and more immersed in the situation. And Sato is literally being dragged closer and closer into the inner circle throughout this entire process. And more we find him getting into the like inner workings of Chihari Kai and like going, okay, I'm putting you in front of my boss to give him this information, and we're going to do each other favors now. I'm going to embed you with the top guy because this is how we're going to disrupt the everything that's going on with Tozawa clan. So I really liked that. I thought that was really great. But what starts off the sort of deeper investigation into this insurance scheme and these connections between cases is this great Rinko Kikuchi series and sequence of events where we actually get to see her come alive. And Katie, you said there's a case in here that sort of kicks off before we even get to the wider investigation. How did you view it? Because it's Rinko investigating a murder and pitching it to her editors. Is that's and I've always found it as a separate entity that she's trying to pitch forward and trying to get some runs on the board with and show that about the, you know, the impacts of violence on women in Tokyo, and just the way they treat her and dismiss her in that office because she's a woman, she essentially has to fight for it to even get featured in the paper. That's basically the gist of this whole thing, and it really kind of like knuckles down on her character. Is that how you viewed it? It's not connected to what we're doing in the wider
show. That is that I was a little bit confused because she's sort of working on it concurrently. I mean, so she starts getting intrigued by the suicides that Jake is investigating, and it's actually really fun to see her kind of get energized by it. And Jake comes and brings this idea to her, and she, you know, runs and remembers that there's a suicide from a few weeks ago and pulls out the exact newspaper from the archive. And like, that's what's so great about watching like a period newspaper film, is like everything's so tangible, and it's like, oh, we're gonna go dig through the actual archive of something and pull out a paper, and it's much more dramatic than doing a search on a database. But although I'm sure, you know, someone can make a database search really interesting, Michael Mann. David Fincher.
Yes. Two people who love a database search.
Yeah. You know, as she's getting energized by it. And I think this episode's really interesting because we see, you know, she's a really good journalist too. And we see her approach is so different from Jake's, because they go to interview another person and the husband of a woman who has killed herself. And she speaks Korean, and she connects with him as a human being, as, oh, I know that town that your wife is from. And Jake is just sort of like bursting into places and demanding answers and kind of bumbling around all over the place, and sort of like a golden retriever who just like is, you know, can't be contained. And she's like,
I literally wrote in quotation marks in my notes, sore thumb. Like, he's just this gigantic sore thumb that just sticking out. He's just such a big, lumbering sore thumb in this episode, particularly. It's intended. It's part of.
And she, you know, she shows him, you know, kind of how to be subtle. And like at one point, like she said, she has some really good lines in this where like he's like, oh, this guy's wife and that guy's husband, or this girl woman's husband, and she goes, they have names, Jake. And it's this like just this really subtle reminder that like these are people. And we need to respect them, and we need to treat them in their grief like people who are, you know, going through something really challenging, and that they're not just like a story and a clue and a source and all of this stuff, which is kind of how Jake is approaching it. And we also see, which I thought was really interesting, we also see how Emmy is sort of forced to, you know, there's this whole interaction between the press and the police, and the glad handing and the bribing and the, oh, I brought you a coffee. Oh, I brought you a fruit. Oh, we're helping with, you know, we're doing each other favors, just in the same way that like the police and the Yakuza do each other favors. And now Jake is in this web of favors as well. But, you know, we see her go out to dinner, and she's investigating this murder of this young woman. We see her go out to dinner with these cops who are so creepy, and they're hitting on her and they're trying to get her drunk. But we see that this is the way that she has to function. You know, she's sort of grinning and bearing it and being like, well, what did you think about this autopsy? You know, this guy confessed, but actually it seems like he didn't hit her on the head. He strangled her. Like, what about that? So it's an interesting way to see her as a true journalist as well. She's not just a cog in the Macho machine. She's trying to get things done as well. So to see her come alive, as you said, is really quite a treat.
And also it's nice to see, it's a rare thing, and people have referenced it more explicitly in reference to Michael Mann, as like, oh, he's seeing someone who's not so good at their job yet. You know, someone who hasn't quite acquired all of those professional skills. I mean, one of the closest is probably Collateral, you know, the difference between someone who is a stone cold professional in the you know, the worst industry possible, which is assassination, and just like a cab driver who is a fish out of water. And so Jake is like obviously going further and further up, becoming more attuned to the way things work. This is a part of that, but it's actually great to see, you know, Rinko Kikuchi's character be the actual expert and show you how you have to navigate it, and then also really outline the frustrations of people, not just an outsider, not this like stupid white savior complex or anything like that, where he's the guy that comes in to solve the whole thing and knows how to do it better than everyone else. It's mm-hmm. like there is a frustration within the existing ecosystem that says like, I just want this to be done. Like, I just want this to be over. This episode, and I'm sorry, this is my fault. I didn't go back. So this episode is written by Naomi Zucker and it's directed by Hikari. And if you haven't heard that name or you're not sure who, it's Hikari's the director of a film from 2019 called 37 Seconds, 2011 called Suyako. A couple of other things, I'm trying to see if there's anything other than shorts, but there's like lots of shorts direction, and previously has been an actress, and funny enough, like a Spring Festival dancer in Memoirs of a Geisha, who is now taken to the lens. And this is a very interesting couple of episodes because it's the most sensual, I guess, that realizes the sensuality of some of the characters in really the whole episode run.
Yeah, it's like Hikari directs episodes 4 and 5 and all the sex scenes are in episodes 4 and 5. I got to say, I appreciate her work on the sex scenes. I think in terms of the direction, I'm a little bit mixed on some of her directorial choices. I think there are some scenes in these couple of episodes that I kind of wish were a little bit more dynamically directed, but I think the sex scenes are really good. And they're very sexy and erotic, aside from the love hotel where Jake and Sato pay a visit. We do get to see Ansel Elgort in a sex scene, and kind of wish it was. I don't know what to say.
I don't usually when we do our shows, like I do take lots of like. People would probably not be surprised. I take lots of notes. I write lots of, I have little thoughts and I write them. And I usually try and sort of effortlessly now and seamlessly weave them into the show without you guys knowing. Like, this is me referring to note one. But one of the things I even said to Katie is I have to read out the note that I wrote during this episode, which is just quite simply, Ansel Elgort having sex is gross. And I think, this guy is a big fish out of water and as this kind of chase love interest in a lot of different things that we've seen him in, very suited to it, kind of innocent, good looking, all that sort of stuff. But when it's made manifest in this show in the next couple of episodes, it's kind of like, oh, I don't, this guy for me, this is the bridge too far moment of like where I'm like, everything that Ansel's doing, multilingual, fish out of water, American, really kind of pushing back on the whole white savior thing. This guy is not a white savior. He's a really frustrated journalist about, imposing what he believes to be journalistic foundations of journalistic integrity on this system that doesn't function in those same ways. But the grossest thing that happens in this whole series is this sex scene for me. It's so gross. His sex scene is so gross. Sato, on the other hand.
Oh, my God.
Sato, on the other hand. Okay. Sho Kasamatsu.
That's from episode 5.
We're not going to talk anymore about that. But that's, wow. That's a different kettle of fish.
It's good. I was trying to think of the idiom for what Ansel is. He's like the frog in the soup. Is that an idiom?
I don't know if it's an idiom, but you know what? We're idioms. So I think for us it is.
But what he's like, whatever, he's the fly in the ointment, or he's like, he's not, like we keep talking about how he's unskilled, but he's so disruptive that he's like, that things, he's a squeaky wheel. Like he's getting things done because he's just like flopping around, causing trouble. And so,
are you talking about his sex scene again? Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
I know.
We haven't had enough sleep.
But he's like, he's not an expert, but he's just so fucking annoying that people are like, oh God, we got to fix this kid. We got to guide him so that he doesn't fuck it up too much. But yeah, it's there were some noises that he made in the sex scene that I didn't appreciate. I didn't appreciate it at all.
I don't like I'm really uncomfortable.
Okay, because
we've talked about sex. This is Tokyo Nice. It's part of Miami Vice. We've talked deeply about the sex that, for example, the great Gong Li and Colin Farrell's characters have. And
hashtag leg maneuver.
Leg maneuvers. Right? The actual realistic the realistic movements that happen in sex as opposed to like Hollywood sex. And just him just talking about it, I'm like, ugh, no.
You're like, stop.
No, stop. It's like disturbing. It's not me being a prude. It's just me thinking someone is gross.
It is really interesting at the end of their encounter. He gives her a rose. It's super sweet. They're all loved up. And then Sato comes out and gives her like a couple $100. And he's like, wait, what? Like, and she's just like, call me anytime. And it's actually such a great,
It's a great
twist.
Yeah, it's a great bait and switch. And Sato's like, yeah, of course she's a prostitute. Who would have sex with you?
Who would go to this creepy ass hotel room with you?
it's so good. It's, but there's something like here where also on the side of the case, so Amy, Rika Kikuchi's character is like really drilling in, those things that there's a universality in the journalism too about like actionable leads, don't miss things, be patient. And,
yes.
And I think one of the things that this episode made me think of is like, it is a series of trying to break cycles that people can't break out of. So with her investigation, it's trying to break cycles to bring more, bring more notoriety to violence against women. And the editors basically think that she's a curio. So they just want to push her to the side and to the fringe. And you can keep serving us drinks at our parties and keep these underlings in line, but we're not going to give you any kind of serious attention. And with this investigation into the insurance, it's like, no, we have to be really journalistically thorough and make everything absolutely concrete to go through. And it's them trying to break a cycle and her having a vision for what the cycle that needs to be broken. And even Sato wanting to break the cycle of going down the path through the Shikari Kai and doing all these things. And it's like people are trying to break cycles and they're just not, they are stuck. And I guess that's what brings us to, I guess, the other massive emotional crux of the episode, which is Samantha, Rachel Keller. We actually get a glimpse into how this very mysterious, very alluring, very savvy character got into this situation. And she seems to meet a formidable figure that is much more slippery and much more formidable than really any of the other dopes that she goes and convinces to buy her drinks and get her tips and make her the most popular, or second most popular girl at their club. And so, yeah, that this is like where we start to see that and getting these little inferences into her past, which is like, oh, okay, where is this going? What is going to happen here? And before that we get to the next episode, where we really start to see that fleshed out. This was a kind of really good, really nice taster, a nice appetite for what's coming.
Yeah. And I can't remember, what is that client's name? The guy who's chasing her. I cannot remember his name.
I've got to find it.
Yeah. I'm looking. Okay. Well, I just want to say the way that he's a client, she thinks that he's, just some other guy. They're having a nice dinner. And then, he tells her, he's like, I'm tracking you down. I'm taking photographs of you, and these people that you stole money from, like, want justice, or they want you to come back, or they want you to pay it back, whatever it is, they want to get her. And he says, to her, he goes, as your people would say, choose the right. And so we do ultimately, and then later at the end of the episode, she's looking at this ring that says CTR, and basically, she's a Mormon. And I just love how this show presents the Mormon church as like another gang or like another organized crime religion. Like, he's like, as your people would say, choose the right. And you're like, oh my God, these people are terrifying.
Sorry,
they're
it's
like,
Matsuo. Matsuo is the
Matsuo,
guy.
Matsuo, yes. Okay, thank you. And they've hired this really scary guy to track her down. And, you know, it's like rings and symbols and rhetoric and all this stuff. It's like, these are just another Yakuza. The Mormons are just another Yakuza. The way they're presented.
I was just going to say, it's like, you're so spot on. And it's like, and it's also that they're weird hierarchies as an outsider.
Yeah, it's power and that, systems.
Yeah, it's like, you have to do this, you have to fulfill this, we will give you this money, but you owe us, you're in our debt. And Samantha is literally in her debt because she capitalizes on, you know, this charitable...
we do find out in the next episode, she's like stolen a bunch of money from this organization. But also another aspect of them that's similar is like the recruiting. So yes, she's gone to Japan on this missionary trip and she's trying to tell people about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And it's like, it's an element of, I mean, Sato's doing the same thing. They're finding these little punks. I might be bleeding into episode 5, but it's just like the Mormons are Yakuza. They are.
This is one wrinkle I didn't see in the Book of Mormon play.
So it's I enjoy that presentation of it, that kind of treatment of them is like it's like scary organization, this intimidating organization. She's also, I mean, she's really up Schitt's Creek at this point in time because she's told some of the girls about her club. She has this whole fantasy about being the madam of this club. And she's trying to get a piece of real estate to rent. And then someone, I think it's Molly, spills the beans to Duke, who's her like idiot manager. And suddenly Chihara Kai are like, oh, well, you need to pay. And it's so funny because they're like, everybody pays. I'm like, this girl doesn't even have a club yet. But there's like an interaction where Kume tells Sato, like, go tell her that she needs to pay. Go intimidate her a little bit. And of course, he doesn't. He's got a huge crush on her, but she kind of rebuffs him. And it's just, you know, so she's just kind of in a bad way. You know, she can't even get one foot forward in this plan to start her own club, you know, before she's got the other girls, her manager, the Yakuza breathing down her neck. So and now she has this other guy to deal with. So she's really having a bad week.
Let's take a quick break and let's just dive straight in. This is going to be a double episode. You guys will probably see that on the thing. Let's just take a quick break now and then we'll just dive straight back in because we've gone from I Want It That Way. We've started bleeding into Everybody Pays. And I feel like about the Hikari episodes because they do feel, and I remember watching them long ago when I watched them together for the first time, they felt like they went through seamlessly. It's like, I've got to keep watching to see what happens. So let's take a quick break and then we'll just dive straight into Everybody Pays.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, so we just were talking about Matsuo, who's a mysterious businessman who comes in and creates a massive problem for Samantha. Does this brings back a vision of her past and her I guess sins that arrived her in this place, and she's stripped all those past ephemera away, become this new person, but it's coming back to bite her. These cycles just seem to keep repeating. And the title of the episode, Everybody Pays, as Katie said just before the break, is like, that's in essence what this is here. There's always a cost. It doesn't, you may not see it apparently straight away, but it's, you know, it may not be apparent right away, but there is always a cost. Then at the same time, Jake is enlisted to help find the mole in the Chihari Kai. And that sort of starts to parcel out, and he must then, once that happens, figure out what that relationship is with him and Ishida. Once I start to illuminate these things or potentially bring these things to bear, what's the cost of the favors that I then have power to and calling on them? And does that mean I'm in someone else's debt? And then finally there is, you know, we get to see that Sato, who has been a guy who is walking the knife's edge between being all in his clan and all in as a Yakuza, and someone who is really railing against this kind of, I don't know, like trying to get off of the inevitability of this sort of this career choice, this life choice. And in some ways, this episode both shows you him railing away from it as far as he can and basically fatalistically kind of determining that this is now his life forever at the same time.
Yeah.
It's quite a good episode. This is one of my favorite episodes of the whole
series. It's a great episode. And I'm just looking at my notes. I'm like, the amount of ground this episode covers is absolutely insane. We start in 1994 with Sam in her missionary life and a flashback to her missionary life. It ends with a bloodbath.
Absolute bloodbath.
I mean, we finally see, you know, we're seeing main characters getting killed off in this episode. We're seeing sex scenes. We're seeing all kinds.
Much better sex scene. Much
yes.
better.
We're seeing all there. I mean, like, for all the sort of like mixed bag I am on some of like Hikari's directorial choices, to cover this amount of information in a cohesive way in one in like 55 minutes is absolutely insane, and it flows really beautifully, and it makes sense, and it feels right, and like this is a fantastic episode, but yeah, it is all about like what you said, you know, the favors, the actual money, and then how do you pay in loyalty and in blood, which is the deal that Sato finds himself.
Not there's a whole thing here where. And it starts off with Jake and our most devastatingly, really like our devastatingly attractive and rapscallion police officer, Miyamoto.
Miyamoto. Love him.
he's one of your guys for sure. having this sort of encounter, doing martial arts together, shooting the breeze, and them talking about this currency of favors, and that even when you're starting to entertain them, and having to do favors for people, there's this fine line that it's like, if you accept it in return, it's over. You've right. embraced the system. The system is the favors. The system is the you do for me, I do for you. This like perpetual cycle of like, I'm going to do it. And so there's a whole, you know, one of the things that I kept thinking about is like, if you lay down with dogs, you know, that line, the great line from Miami Vice is like, if you lay down with dogs, and, you know, Sonny's really, you know, blatant reaction, like, go fuck yourself in Miami Vice, is like, because in that moment, he's immersing himself. He's getting lost in the character of who he is. He's getting lost in Isabella. And in this episode, it's all about that. It's like, you get to see these different characters and the weight that all those favors and the time that they've been doing it has on them. And I, that was my first and one of my very, very, very favorite things with Miyamoto, was like him there just doing this martial art, sort of shooting the breeze. But all the weight of all the years of being a cop in that system and having to play with those favors, it leaves a mark.
Yeah. But also, I mean, he absolutely wrecks Jake in Aikido, yeah, which is, nice. Which is nice. Like a repayment for that steak dinner he walked out on, he stiffed him on. But yeah, watching him wreck Jake in Aikido was very entertaining. But yeah, I mean, and the, you know, Miyamoto plants like a seed of doubt in Katagiri with Jake. I mean, he's like, why is he doing this? And then Jake goes to Katagiri and he's literally like, why are you doing this? And Katagiri's got a great explanation, which is, you know, don't we have an interest as the law enforcement of the city to keep a gang war under wraps? Like, if I can help figure out this mole situation with Ishida and like settle it, you know, between, you know, under wraps between these two gangs instead of letting it spiral out of control, like that serves me as the chief of police in this city. So that's basically the go-between between Jake and Ishida. Ishida, who, you know, has contacted Jake through Sato, who's like, here's my friend, you know, another favor. He's like, oh, by the way, I know this journalist and he can totally talk to the police for you and like you'll find out what's going on, why the police won't drink your tea. And they discover that they have a mole in Ishida and it's going back to Tozawa. He's got a double agent, basically. And then, you know, Ishida gives him the little tip about the matchbox and says, don't look for who gave these people the money, the loans that caused these people to commit suicide. He's like, look for the people who rejected them. The other thing is that they do figure out, I think, is it in the previous episode? They figure out the insurance thing that...
Yes, that was a previous episode.
The banks are the beneficiaries of the life insurance policies. So when these people die, these loan sharks get the life insurance policy payout. So as Jake says, he's like, oh, they've monetized suicide. And so, so now they're looking for who is running these banks and they're trying to go up the ladder. But the problem is that in the system, like, as we've seen with the Tozawa guys, there's a million guys who will just be like, oh, it's me, I'll do it. And they take the blame. And that's kind of what's happening. Like, you're never going to get the biggest fish because there's always going to be a million fall guys in between. So, like, Jake is really trying to, like, scramble up this pile of bodies, basically, to find the bigger fish. But... you know, it. Nobody really wants to go all the way to the top.
No, and it's really funny because you're looking at it as an outsider, and especially because it's a period piece, and you're like, you know, you do those things sometimes where you're like, isn't it weird how those systems work? But it's like not so far long ago in both, I guess, British society and then in turn, like the early American society where the state didn't really get involved in matters of family. So like, for example, if two brothers fought each other and one of them died and the family was like, it's a family matter, the state would just be like, okay.
Mm.
You know, like it, like, and I'm talking about like sort of the formulation of the union times in the mm-hmm. United States, like the state wouldn't interject. It would just be like, and even if there was a duel between two families, they had a dispute. If someone died and both families were like, we're not pressing charges, we're not involving the state, they'd like, okay, there was a dispute and it resulted in death and we're not getting involved. And I feel like that's Katagiri's modus operandi, is like, I don't mind if these guys kill each other.
Right.
But I just can't have them killing, I can't have them killing our citizens because they Yakuza gonna Yakuza. Like they're gonna do what they're gonna do.
Right.
And anything that I can do to keep it confined into their world, their underbelly, and it not break into the streets, that's in my best interests. I've got to do
it. And the Yakuza are self-governing bodies. It's not like he could govern them anyway because they have a whole system of discipline and loyalty and punishment for whatever it is, which is something that we do see in this episode, specifically when Kume takes Sato upstairs and he's going to tell he basically doesn't think that Sato has like straightened out Samantha. So he is like, he takes him to the roof and he's like, cut your finger off.
Yeah.
And they've got a whole ritualistic table to do this. This has happened before. And by this point in the episode, I may be jumping ahead a little bit, but we have discovered now that Kume is the Tozawa mole.
Yes.
And Ishida intervenes on this finger chopping ceremony. And he's just like, you're a mole. You have to kill yourself. But Kume won't do it. He's like, oh, he's like, jump off the roof. And he's like, no, you do it. But he's making this argument. He's saying, Tozawa's like a businessman. He's a leader. He's doing this. He's doing that. And this is kind of where we see this like righteous path thing of the Chiharakai, which is like, we find out that Tozawa is basically importing meth. And Ishida's like, so I should poison people? Like I should be selling poison, like just because these guys are. Kume is this sort of like ruthlessly psychopathic, just like striver who wants to be with whoever's the big, you know,
whoever's the biggest dog. He wants to be attached to it. And we've already seen Sato observe his embrace and his ascension to the higher ranks of the Chiharakai. And we're like, oh, okay, good. He's very motivated and he wants to get there. And it moved Sato emotionally. So they've got this emotional connection together. And the Samantha thing is his second indiscretion because he beats the crap out of one of his fellows and then he gets a dressing down for beating up one of his peers. And then the Samantha thing the second time is the second indiscretion. And so him being on that roof is like, all right, I'm ready to chop off my finger. And instead, Ishida says, no, kill him.
Right. So then Ishida says to Sato, like, oh, you kill your older brother, basically, your mentor.
Yes.
And he can't do it. And God, it's really heartbreaking when Kume says, it's okay, little brother. I know you can't do this. And he jumps off the roof. Or he says something like that. But
yes. Okay.
And then Ishida's like just saying to Sato, like, what the fuck? You have to be able to kill people if you're a Yakuza. And he says, the choice is yours. And like, that's a theme that keeps coming back. Like at one point in this episode, Sato is recruiting a new guy and he says, the choice is yours. And he knows that the guy will come and make the choice to join. Cause he's also like, do you want to be a loser your whole life? But in this episode, it's not set. It's only said maybe once, but it was a phrase that kept popping into my head the entire time I was watching this episode. The choice is yours. And it's always with Sato. Like, it, at the end, when we see this incredibly bloody confrontation with Ishida and these assassins, I'm like, I was thinking again, like, the choice is yours. Are you going to jump into this and be involved in this? You know? So,
before we get to the bloodbath, which I want to talk about in a whole bunch of ways.
Yes.
I think anyone who was viewing the Jake and Samantha relationship as potentially romantic, which a couple of times they've been sharing, they're both expats, they're finding these commonalities, maybe they've got something to run from, they've got a lot of things in common.
I think he thinks it might be romantic.
He thinks, yeah. And if you've been so aligned with Jake that that's the way you're going to view it, that's sure. But there has been a lot of very palpable and thoroughly enjoyable sexual tension between Sam and Sato. And in this episode, when burdened with everything that's going on with Matsuo and trying to figure out how to solve this problem and basically realizing that the vice is closing in on her, she doesn't have an option to get out of this thing, it's really nice to see them actually collide. And for the tension that's been building for now 5 hours of show to be realized, it's a very, very great encounter.
I have to say that there's nothing like, I mean, I think this show actually does have, I mean, this was a great sex scene, but it's because it builds on 5 hours of tension.
Yes.
And so I think there's been a lot of discussion, especially online and in various articles about like the death of the sex scene. And I'm just sort of like, yes, we're getting some good sex scenes. But I think that they're good because they are built upon character and relationship, and we like want to see these people come together. It's not just about how it's shot or bodies or whatever you want to say. It's like, it's that tension. And she and Sato have sort of been like at each other. She's blown him off in the last episode. She also kind of blows him off in this episode. At one point, she like goes and hangs out with Jake. And Jake is just like whining about his job. And she's just like, oh my God, shut up.
Shut up. And
Sato then confronts her because he's felt rejected. And he's like, everybody pays. And they start making out in the locker room and then end up back at her place and have like a, it's a, all this built up tension, but then the sex scene itself is actually quite like intimate and tender. And they have this great like pillow talk afterwards where they're like sharing about each other and each other's lives and actually coming together. It's like, it's the kind of, you know, I talk a lot about how like these like grown up sex scenes are like in Michael Mann films are very refreshing to see. And like, this is another one of that, that fits into that genre where it's like, this is sexy and relatable and it's intimate and it's built on character.
And also the great thing about it is that both of these characters throughout all the five episodes have these moments of like bluster and confrontation and brah-rah, and they get in each other's face and have the aggro. And then when they finally come together, not only do they strip away their clothes, they strip away all that bullshit.
Yeah.
And it's an incredibly intimate scene and they're very tender with one another. And it's like, it's actually nice. Oh, these are who maybe these people are. Like finally, yeah. Samantha's taking away all the like, I'm too cool for school. And Sato's taking away all that like hard edge. I'm the tough Yakuza guy. And which blends perfectly into an absolutely outstanding. And I think equally intimate and messy,
yes,
violent confrontation, because the end of the show really finalizes with Ishida's beautiful home being infiltrated by a group of gangsters and all of the Shiharikai soldiers who are on duty as security that night are taken out, murdered. And he's almost fatally injured, and Sato discovers this sort of, I don't know, this infiltration right in the clutches of like Ishida defending his life. And it comes in, the camera is frantic because Sato is frantic, the movements and the fights are frantic and messy and not and confined, because this beautiful unit is not, it's not like this big open space where you can swing around a sword and take people out. It's like messy and stairs and wood and different levels. And it's such a, I really loved the action direction here, because it's not, it's a kind of frantic and panicked discovery, and everything feels like it's that you're embodying Sato's panic and like, what the hell do I do?
Yeah, and it's an interesting, like, I like that you mentioned that it comes right after the sex scene, because like, you know, he and Sam are face to face in this sort of like intimate physical connection, and then suddenly he's face to face with a masked, you know, swordsman in an intimate physical connection, and they're struggling, and like, you don't know. There's this one scene where they're on the stairs and you don't know who has the knife and who's going to get stabbed, penetrated, if you will. And at one point you see just like this blood spray on his shirt, and you're like, wait, did he get stabbed or did the other person get stabbed? And it's this sort of like slow coming together. And then you realize that it's the other guy's blood spraying on him. But it's like this moment of confusion, like that reflects probably his own confusion in that moment. I really liked that as well. And then, you know, he's about to get, you know, he's taken out some guys, he's defending Ishida, who seems to be down for the count, and he has a great moment where, you know, Sato's just getting strangled and suddenly like there's a sword through the chest and it's the old Yakuza himself is back on his feet, at least for a moment.
The old dog survives for how long, yes. We're not sure. Hearing you talk about embraces with surprise bodily functions And then, who was that? Was that me?
Was that me?
Was way hornier than I was expecting.
Oh my God, I didn't. That was not intended.
You have a gift. This is, you have an amazing gift. And I think that that's the perfect way to wrap up. So this has been a double episode of Tokyo Nice. I want it that way and everybody pays. And this is because the Kahari episodes, as the director, is something that we wanted to focus on. The first episode, I Want It That Way, was written by Naomi Izuka, and Adam Stein comes in to write Everybody Pays. There are three more episodes to go. We'll probably do a couple more in here. I know there's a couple of guests that have been talking about maybe popping on and saying hello. So we're going to try and get those folks involved if we can. Otherwise, we're going to catch you on more episodes of Miami Nice. And around the time you're hearing this, we're going to probably have a lot of these episodes drop pretty quickly so you can do a bit of catch up on those first five episodes. But then we've got to throw on Miami Nice in there because we do have one of our leads, speaking of leads in Miami Vice and Tokyo Vice as well, one of our leads has deep dived on all the potential endings that were. So Katie and I need to really get back to Miami to get into that before we finalize. and then we'll take out the show and we'll kind of give you a bit of a summation on what we think of the whole show. But so far, I think for me, the first five episodes of the series overall, really some of the strongest telly all shows. It really comes down to how does it resolve everything that we're seeing. But, you know, from Michael Mann to this crescendo of this violence, I was just like, this was a really satisfying so far series for me in these five episodes.
Yeah, there's a lot going on and it's really been a fun watch. So I've enjoyed unpacking them with you.
I've enjoyed being in embrace and bodily fluids happening and neither of us knowing which one it was.
Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.